dedicate this episode to the memory of Ray Stevenson.
We do. RIP to a real one.
God keep you, brother.
Yeah.
It really is sad. He was really young.
Yeah. Yeah. What was he, like, very late 50s, early 60s?
Yeah. 58, I think.
I thought he was, like, early 50s. I could be wrong.
Okay.
It's certainly in the 50s. Certainly very much in the that's no age category.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A veteran of many of our podcasts, since we also recently reviewed The Three Musketeers.
Yeah.
Another great Ray Stevenson performance where he's essentially playing Titus Pullo.
He is,
but just in a different era.
Yeah. Yeah, different era, different costume, different shape of hat.
Yeah, yeah. But ultimately, you know, the shape of the hat doesn't change the man.
It does not.
That's what I learned.
It does not.
Welcome back to Rome. It's season two. It's episode one. We are back. It's me, Milo Edwards, and I'm joined by my esteemed colleagues, Phoebe Roy and Patrick Wyman. How are we doing?
Hey.
Happy to be here.
Mm. We are very happy to be here.
Very happy to be here. We've just been talking about crocodiles.
We have. We have been talking about crocodiles.
An appropriately ancient beast.
They are an ancient beast.
They're an ancient beast.
They're up there with Livia of the Julii in terms of ancient beasts.
In terms of ancient beasts, yeah.
Yeah. Raw power.
Yeah.
Raw power. And yeah, on the subject of ancient beasts.
I actually have a question
about
ancient beasts and the crocodiles and so on. This is actually more directed at Pat because with all possible love in my heart, Milo, I don't think you know the answer.
with all due respect, which is none, Milo, you're a fucking idiot. And I will be addressing this question to the learned Dr. Wyman. I don't want a joke answer. I want an actual factual
answer to my question.
I'm appreciating that you just delved right into the subtext there of the like tore it into confetti and threw it up in the
air.
What
I was born to do, Patrick.
Phoebe, what is your question?
It's very specifically about crocodiles and other similarly ancient reptiles. Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of claim of lineage, like from crocodiles in the ancient world? Are there any kind of royal houses who sort of say we were originally a crocodile?
We were originally one big crocodile.
Well, like, because there's loads of really, really peculiar medieval English mythography and sort of mytho history which kind of claims ancestry from you know, kind of women who look like women but were covered in scales and lots of Arthurian,
a night out in Newcastle,
etc. Lots of like Arthurian legend is about kind of claiming lineage from sort of various sort of semi-mythical and also real beasties. And there's quite a lot of Greek myth about there being a kind of family progenitor that's like either a snake or half a snake or something. So Was there any kind of we are the royal house and we are descended from the crocodile?
I honestly do not know the answer to that question. I would say I would be surprised if there wasn't, but the serpent seems to be a much more not quite universal but widely distributed kind of mythological progenitor. So you see it a lot in Southeast Asia, in places that were influenced by the kind of like the Hindu royal models that moved outward from India in the first few centuries AD, right? They go into Indonesia and Burma, what's now Thailand, Cambodia. There was a fusing of the kind of royal associations of the serpents there with an indigenous tradition that placed a lot of emphasis on serpents as kind of granters of power. But I don't know specifically about crocodiles. I would be surprised if there wasn't, but I just don't know about that one specifically. So if you like go to the really ancient temples around Angkor, like not Angkor itself, but there's a ton of serpent imagery. And it seems to be true. Like that's a really prominent example of it, but there's tons and tons. Like, serpents are associated all over the world with kind of the powers of the earth and like deep, dark, ancient kind of stuff. And it's often contrasted with more recently arriving religious imagery and motifs. So like, if you dig down to the really deep layers of a religious tradition, you'll often find serpents there as like kind of coming directly from the earth, springing out of the earth. It's interesting. I don't know that much about like comparative mythology, but that's my understanding.
Yeah, well, the first king of Thebes is supposed to have been descended from serpents, but that is, in comparative mythology terms, that is used as an example of the existence of a kind of lost Indo-European mythology because of the way that these motifs appear across different cultures and across different languages.
I like the idea of the first king of Thebes doing the kind of authentocrat stuff that they do in modern politics. I'll tell you what, I'm not like them bloody softies over nothings, right? My father were a snake.
That's the opposite, though, of being an authentocrat, because if there's this sort of idea of...
Oh, my mother were a shoe.
of it being like the kind of a locus of magical royal power. This is like someone referring to people as what is it they call people who didn't go to the right public school? Oik.
I don't know. Oiks. I think oik is too broad, surely.
There's a specific word which means that you went to St. Paul's but not Eton. I know, fucking hell.
Is it such a
disaster of a country?
Wow.
That's the most English shit I've ever heard.
Oh.
Just like... I mean, there's a picture I'm very fond of a bald shirtless guy with a bunch of shitty tattoos and a gold chain around his neck, sitting with his arms folded at a Man U game.
Oh, yeah.
And like that to me is England. Yeah.
Well, that guy went like to St. Paul's, but not Eton.
Well, that guy was descended from a snake. He's actually extremely aristocratic.
Mm.
He is, yeah. But like, if that dude represents one half of England as a thing, the word for somebody who went to St. Paul's but not Eton, the specific word is the other. Like, that's the duality of England.
This is the thing about Britain, is it produces like incredibly powerful but laser-specific vibes and types of guy, which if you learn to differentiate them are really distinct. Like, the energy of someone who went to, like, a main brand public school versus the energy of someone who went to a minor public school is two distinct kind of things. They're distinct varieties of posh knobhead, but it is like, it's a different vibe, and it pains me to say, you really can tell the difference.
And do you know what there is actually? This is not even an expert segue. There are such a lot of parallels in the Roman Republic with these kinds of guys.
You know, like, what Britain's modeling itself on. Yeah.
Like Cicero is the most fucking Wickhamist.
Oh, no, more minor. He's like a fucking Wellington College ass, rugby school type.
No, rugby is less minor than Wellington College.
But Wickham is Winchester's one of the big boys. Definitely.
Yeah, maybe Winchester's one of the big boys.
I think, yeah, you're talking like a...
We've undermined
Clifton
the point
College.
We've undermined the point that we were trying to make here, I think, by knowing quite so much about it. No, it's just
A Stowe School MF.
No, just because, like, you read a kind of certain sort of novel written in the 1950s, and like, there are the sort of fail sons who are at the rugby school.
Yeah, yeah. Cicero went to Oundle. I'm just enjoying naming these now. Why do I know them?
Cicero was an old Wainflet.
These can't be fucking real. These places can't be real. I refuse to believe that these are real places that are real names of institutions that generations of fail sons have attended. Yeah. Actually, when put that way, I 100%
believe. Would you like to know the worst bit, which is that if you are an old Wainfleet, which is spelt Wainflet, just so we're clear, if you are an old Waynefleet, you might think that means that you went to a school called Waynefleet, right? No, it means you went to Magdalen.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
If it can't hurt me, if it's not, if I don't believe it's real.
That's true.
I refuse to. I'm going to block this conversation out of my head. I'm going to pretend I never learned any of this. Ignorance is absolute fucking bliss.
It's arcana, really, which is appropriate to what we're discussing.
This is going to be your sleep paralysis demon. You're going to wake up going, oh, Westminster. Yeah.
Your sleep paralysis demon is a guy with a signet ring going, Patrick, you've got to try some of this Charlie. It's fucking classic.
Have you ever heard of dubstep? It's fucking sick.
That's it.
God
Matey,
damn it.
Put the kids to bed. We're going to fucking infernos.
My brain, like my brains are literally leaking out of my goddamn ears right now. To your point, I'm going to get us back on track if it's the last thing I do here. I see the parallel in the way that all of these aristocrats in both the actual Rome and in the show Rome, which I think they do a fantastic job of pointing out, are obsessed with these subtle gradations of status, incredibly subtle things that no outsider knows, but which matter an insane degree to them, that are these little markers of identity and status within the most incredibly powerful class of people that you can imagine. Like they're so into this. And I think the show does a great job of that. I think it's a great way in which it reflects the actual society
Absolutely.
It's portraying.
And I think that that goes alongside with something that we talk about quite a lot for this show, which is that there is the correct vocabulary for everything, and that need not have any connection with the material reality. So in this episode, we have Anthony saying that he is going to be like Cincinnatus, and there's nobody on earth who is a less appropriate comparant for Cincinnatus than Anthony. And he's sort of saying it as a joke, but it's also not a joke, not exactly. It's something which is sort of part of the kind of the atmospheric content, and it's what all of the characters drawn, even as they are in these entirely uncharted waters of the aftermath of the assassination of Caesar. None of them know what the protocol is, and that scares the life out of them, because if nothing else, Romans of the late Republic loved protocol, because actually all they had.
Well, because no one had thought to come up with a protocol for what if they assassinated Caesar.
I mean,
just assume that wouldn't happen.
I mean, pretty much this is sort of the narrative underpinning of the entire episode, which is that unwittingly the assassins of Caesar have got themselves into a very, very particular Roman legal knot, which we will go into.
It's giving like Brexit vibes, you know,
a little bit,
in terms of, you know, they're now stuck with the Northern Ireland Protocol. No one thought about any of this.
Yeah.
You know, Brutus and Cassius have decided to leave the customs union, and now they're in a little bit of a regulatory pickle.
They are in a regulatory pickle, and there is nothing that Romans hated more than being in a regulatory pickle.
It's an enormous line of trucks piled up at a customs checkpoint with no plan for what you're going to do with the trucks now that you've tossed out the framework that you've grown.
And then
accustomed
they look
to.
At the pile of trucks and they go, there is no mid 4th century general that I can conjure up to solve this situation, even just by mentioning him. What do we do?
No. Can't let these amphorae into Northern Ireland. They've not been marked up according to EU regulations.
the Cincinnatus line is, first of all, it's absolutely brilliant writing, right? Because it works on so many different levels. It's like it works as a real reference to a figure in the Roman past. It works as a joke that Antony knows he's making. It works as him mocking the audience that he's talking to, the kind of people that who take the idea of Cincinnatus seriously, and then there's also just the joke of him saying, I'm going to go home and plow my fields and fuck my slaves, as if those aren't exactly the same things. And also exactly what a real Cincinnatus would have done on his farm four centuries earlier. So it works as a series, as an entire bundled series of jokes about Rome itself, about their worship of the past, and about the and about the company in which Antony finds himself. It's just, it's like, it's probably my favorite line of this entire show so far.
It's terrific.
And now additionally, some 17 years later, it works as a call forward to when Boris Johnson compared himself to Cincinnatus.
Yeah, an unwitting call forward.
A man who I feel like in the Roman era would have loved to plow a field and fuck a slave. Like, I just, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I can't see him plowing a field. I won't lie to you. That's not something which I think is within his powers.
There you go. He'd need a sturdy mule.
Could you see him... Yeah, well, I mean, obviously Cincinnatus never plowed a field himself either. Like, could the if we're being honest, could you imagine? But this is actually, I suppose, the more salient comparison. Could you imagine Boris Johnson standing there shouting at a slave who was plowing the field that he's doing it wrong, despite having no knowledge of how the field actually ought to be plowed?
I feel like Boris Johnson his vibe would be, he would be sort of like praising the plowing of the field in a very indirect way in the hopes of seeming appropriately jolly to the people plowing the field. Like going sort of like, bloody good, very straight furrow there, old chap. Yeah, love it. Really,
yeah,
that would be.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's like that. That is what counts in the ancient aristocrat's worldview as "quote unquote" plowing the field, not doing it himself. He's like, or it's the ancient equivalent of that picture of Donald Trump shouting at the kid mowing the White House lawn.
Oh yeah, yeah,
with the lawnmower, where it's just Trump standing there, like always standing strangely, like can't stand like a normal person even for 2 seconds, just shouting at a child.
But
with
you
a
see
lawnmower.
The whales like, are crashing into the winter bines. It went up many more than were ever killed by boats, actually. Many, many more. They're driving the whales a little bit batty. A little bit batty. So I'm just stuck in my head.
Oh, our big wet Donald. Yeah. Oh, we love him. We love him.
Caesar was never killed by a boat.
No, that's true.
And yet now you've got a dead Caesar. People are saying, was it a boat? No, no, no.
It wasn't a windmill either, though. In all fairness, in all fairness to this analysis, it was not a windmill.
I should at this point, before we get into any more deep dive about this episode, I should say we are talking season 2, episode 1, Passover.
Looking at me when you say that.
No, I was looking at you for confirmation that there's no reason why it's called that. I didn't know any references.
No, I don't.
To
think so.
either the Jewish holiday or any other kind of Passover. I'm not sure why they've gone with this title.
I guess because
Timon the Jew does play a substantial role in this episode. Mm. Maybe it was a shout out to Timon.
It's nice to have a shout out to Timon.
No,
yeah.
he's the hardest working person in this entire show. He's the only one with an actual job.
He's the only one with an actual job. He's the only one who doesn't complain all the time.
While we were watching this at one point, Annabelle was like, what's that? What is that guy's name? And I was like, oh, Timon. She was like, oh, I thought he was called Simon, which just sounded really weird in this context. I was like, well, he is Jewish, so it's probably not that weird if he'd been called Simon. I was like, one of the characters is called Mark.
I love that Mark Antony is called Mark. I know that they wouldn't have called him Mark, but I just always think of him just being as, you know, like your mate's new boyfriend.
Yeah.
Like, oh, here he is. He's Mark. Yeah. All right, you know, he's Mark.
He prefers Mark Antony.
You only need to learn one thing about him, but, you know, he's a nice enough bloke. Mark. Yeah. We like Mark.
Why not?
He's all right.
I would say the equivalent of that in my particular corner of the world is like a Travis. Like, you need her new boyfriend Travis, like, we know Travis, like, yeah, Travis likes Travis likes Coors Light. Like, this is
Driftwood, like, was all right.
This is all we need to know about this is all we need to know about Travis.
It would be very funny if he was called Travis Antony.
Oh yeah. Travius Antonius.
Yeah
that would be good.
Chad Octavian. Yeah.
Travis Antony turning up on his chariot that's got a little Monster Energy decal on the side. That would be nice.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So the plot of this episode, so goes the brief Wikipedia summary. Caesar has been murdered. Mark Antony emerges from the Senate in shock, only to face Quintus Pompey and his thugs, who immediately follow him to try and kill him. Brutus returns home shaking after the murder. His mother is already plotting the return of the Roman Republic. Titus Pullo asks Irene to marry him, and she accepts. Erastes Fulman kidnaps Lucius Verina's children and sister-in-law. Mark Antony proposes an amnesty to the rest of the Senate to keep the peace and allow the Republic to continue. Verina says goodbye to Niobe while Rome says goodbye to Caesar. Verina and Pullo track down Fulman to a bathhouse where he tells them he killed Verina's family. A great sequence, that.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a very narratively rich episode. So should we just sort of get going with the opening? So everyone is reeling from the death of Caesar.
Yeah,
and they have not done the Octavian recasting yet, which they will do. So so Octavian is still played by that beastly little shit. So we've still got.
Definitely eat and mold.
We've still got...
It's not your minor public school.
Well, excuse me of going to a minor public. one of those lads who definitely says, oh, yeah, no, I go to school in Wiltshire and then look at you to see if you know what that means.
Mm. Yeah, where the ham is from.
So I think this scene... It's very important because it is sowing the seeds for Octavian to become the statesman that he becomes, because in the aftermath of this sort of shocking event, he is now the head of the family, he's now the head of the Julia, and he takes charge. And it's also Octavian who points out the bureaucratic Ouroboros that the conspirators have kind of tied themselves up in.
Yeah, I'm descended from the bureaucratic Ouroboros. He was a very important kind of serpentine functionary.
So he's already starting to take over, but because he's still being played by the beastly little shit, you can't quite take him seriously. And in fact, Attia does try to call him a silly boy, and he does take charge of the situation,
which is a climb down from disgusting little pervert.
It's a climb down from disgusting little pervert. But I did threaten both of you with this. I want to talk about Plutarch.
Oh, okay.
We're going to talk about Plutarch. So this is in the matter of Caesar's will. So Octavian and the rest of the Julii insist on the will being opened. And they get, I think it's Caesar's freedman.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Posca.
They get him to read the will out. And
in the show, it's Servilia who insists, and the rest of them are being like, "Oh, we don't have time."
It's not Servilia.
Sorry, not Servilia.
Attia.
Calpurnia.
Calpurnia.
Yeah. God, we're doing really, really well. Everyone is doing fantastically.
I was picturing the right person.
Yeah,
I
know
who
you mean. Yep. So Calpurnia insists on seeing the will because she wants to know, as the matron of a recently murdered politician who may or may not have his memory kind of sort of damned kind of formally. She is in a potentially very tricky situation. So she wants to see whether or not she's been provided for in this will.
Well, the coroners haven't released the death certificate yet. They're still considering a damnatio memoriae. Yeah. That would be a pattern in the world because you can't have him cremated until that's dealt with. So
yeah, that's
just
true.
Waiting on that, really.
You've seen his lungs. Disgusting. Look at that. Look at that. He must have smoked like a chimney.
Yeah.
Yes. So the will gets read, and all of his estates and vast sum of his fortune gets left to Octavian, who has been named as his posthumously adopted heir.
Yeah, there's a great line where he says he leaves 70 denarii to each Roman citizen, and Attia just goes, "What a waste."
Yeah. Good old Attia. Now, the reason I wanted to talk about this is I am interested in this little bit of fictionalization. It's always meaningful in narratives about the ancient world, what they choose to make up and what they choose to keep accurate. This is, according to the source material, this is not what happened with the will of Caesar. What happened with the will of Caesar was it was being kept, as was according to custom, by the Vestal Virgins in the Temple of Vesta. And technically, the Vestal Virgins are not supposed to give, they're not supposed to give a will up until it's being formally read.
Right. Okay.
And according to a story, which is in Plutarch's Life of Antony, which I think is interesting, I'll come on to why I think this is interesting. Octavian shows up and says, I want to see the will. And they said, well, you can't, because that's an offence. That's an offence against our divine persons.
It's virgin policy.
I'm afraid. I can't sign that out to you. I can give you a leaflet about what to do if your great uncle has been declared a tyrant and his death a tyrannicide. We do have some leaflets about that. I can arrange you an away day, but it is policy of this temple not to issue the will.
The problem is, that's how it's in the virgin system. Look, I don't have the power to override it. I would love to help you, but I can't. Look, if you want it, you'd have to take up with Richard Branson.
The computer said no.
I'm looking at the
database, and there's nothing I can do for you, my love. So that's what the Vestal Virgins say.
Yeah.
And then Octavian's apparently said to them, what would you do if I just came in here and just took it? And they say, well, we will not stop you if you do that. That's more than my job's worth. That is more than my job's worth to try and stop him. Do you see him? He comes in here chatting about how he went to some place called Eton. No, I can't be doing with that. I'm due a tea break. I'm going to look the other way. He can take it if he wants.
The Vestal Virgins operated a similar regulatory framework to like most arms of the British government.
Yes.
Where it's like, don't do that. What if I just did it? Well, don't.
We would prefer it if you didn't. So this is what ends up happening. And then Octavian reads it out in public and naming himself as the adopted heir of Caesar. And there is some academic debate about what the real contents of the will might have been. It obviously does not survive. And it would, of course, make perfect sense for Octavian to fictionalize the contents and to name himself the heir. It's a absolutely golden opportunity for him to do that. But the fact that it appears in Plutarch's Life of Antony, which as far as we can tell is probably based on pretty good sources, because it's probably based on the contemporary, now lost contemporary history of this bloke called Asinius Pollio, who was a Roman soldier, statesman, multi-hyphenate.
Donkey chicken.
He was a model actress.
Yeah.
With Asinius Pollio.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. who was a contemporary of all of this crowd, and who wrote this sort of detailed contemporary history. And quite a lot of what is in Plutarch's Life of Antony shows up in other historians, other periods, and other locales, and they all like used each other, admittedly. But if a story is showing up in Appian and Cassius Dio and Suetonius and in Plutarch, chances are this is probably based on a pretty decent contemporary.
One for the Cassius Dio heads there.
One for the Cassius Dio heads.
People who love
a bit of Cassius Dio.
Hellenistic historians.
Some people call him Dio Cassius, but I don't go with that. I don't hold with that. I don't hold with that naming convention. He's Cassius Dio.
Mm.
That's what he was called when I was at university, and that's what he will be called forever.
it's an interesting contrast between that and the way that they've chosen to portray it here, right? They are dramatizing Octavian's ascent to power in a much more direct way, because in reality, Octavian's like 18, 19. He's not 14 or 15 when Caesar dies. Like, they're portraying him as an adolescent here, when in reality he would have been an almost fully grown Roman adult. Yeah, like, I mean, so, like, right on that cusp. So the here they're still keeping him down, and they're still keeping him down, right? Like they're it's a narrative choice that they have made in order to dramatize his ascension to power over the course of this season, to turn that into more of a journey instead of a binary on off switch where suddenly he becomes a fully fledged like political actor. Right. Like they're going to make that the storyline and the transformation and the character arc instead of a switch going.
And one of the big themes which is being established in this episode is the way in which the main actors underestimate each other. They're continually underestimate each other. And just the final point that I'm going to make about this is that sources which relate to the life of Anthony are inevitably entirely not overshadowed, but certainly coloured and contoured by what comes after. At the moment, Anthony and Octavian are kind of about to enter into a kind of uneasy alliance. But the memory of Anthony is of the Battle of Actium, of his terrible fall, and as an enemy of...
He's had a terrible fall. He was getting out of the bath.
He's going to have his hip replaced.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
I've told him he's got to go in a warden-assisted flat, but he won't have it.
He should start lifting weights. Improves your bone density. That's true. It does.
Nobody wants osteoporosis. It is. Nobody wants osteoporosis.
Like, no.
Patrick Wyman's got the bone density of one of those deep sea fishes.
Yeah. Honestly, there's a lot of density in these old bones.
Good.
Here. Yeah.
Good. Glad to hear it. So if anyone is sitting down in the second century AD to write a history of the life of Mark Antony, that is inevitably being framed as Mark Antony, the enemy of Octavian. So if you are including elements of Octavian's rise to power, that is set against Antony's eventual defeat and eventual death in a way that...
Spoilers. Sorry, if any of you weren't familiar...
You know what? It's that bloody William... He thinks he's so clever. He reads to the end of every single story and then he goes, yeah. He stays up all night waiting for the new episodes to come out and then he tells people what went on before they've had a chance to see it. It's disgusting.
You know, the Roman Empire collapses in the middle of the first millennium AD. I just hadn't got to that bit yet.
Constantinople, I don't even know what that is yet. We haven't got to that. We haven't invented
it's still,
it.
It's still Byzantium it's still in Byzantium. This house.
That's Byzantium, mate. So I think it's interesting because
going on holiday to Rome and fully expecting ancient Rome because you've not read to the end of the Roman Empire. So you get, as far as you're concerned, it's still going on.
I'll tell you what, that Gibbons, he does go on. 7 volumes. I couldn't get through it. Couldn't get to the end.
You show up at the Castel Sant'Angelo and are really mad that it's not the Mausoleum of Hadrian. Like, what is all this shit on top? Like, the Vatican? Like, why is there a building here? This is... Like Sabura, like yeah,
this is,
just getting
this is
just
where
getting
the,
really
this is where
confused.
The Pope lives. The who? the what?
No, I only read up to the part where we were crucifying Christians, and now you're telling me they're in charge. Like this is too much for me to handle.
I gotta do some reading. So if we're following a contemporary source, then they are not writing with the full knowledge of how the alliance between Octavian and Antony ends. But when you are composing a biography, at least a century later, You are working with the full knowledge of the kind of the beginning, middle, and end of this episode. So, what I think would be so interesting is to see the difference in contemporary sources for how this episode is portrayed compared to how it is portrayed when it is so important for laying the groundwork and sowing the seeds for the eventual death and defeat of Antony.
Yeah, that's one of the really tough things that this show has to do. And I think it did a pretty good job of it in the first season. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it actually did a pretty extraordinary job of it in the first season of pacing and of maintaining an aura of uncertainty, despite the fact that we knew how it was going to end up, right? Like, this in the second season of this show, I think this honestly is one of my very favorite episodes of either season of Rome. I think it's really, really, really well done. But I think you can also start to see the cracks showing that are going to become a problem over the course of the second season of this show that lead to the ending not being as satisfying mm-hmm. or as fully fledged as you wanted it to be. Like, this show, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that this show didn't get the ending that it deserved. Yeah.
That's definitely true. And also, it's pretty hard to follow the death of Caesar. That's quite a season finale, even though it's like a historical event that took place. That's a finale. That's a finale, all right.
What a twist.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting. I would guess that this episode was written in the same burst of activity that led to them doing the finale. Mm. Like, and I think that after that, they only started writing the rest of this season and especially the later episodes of this season later on, because it feels thematically and especially in terms of pacing of a piece with the first season much more than it does the second season. Like, this feels way more like the falling action of the first season than it does the start of what we, because we've seen this, know is going to happen later mm-hmm. in the season. Like, it feels way more organic. Like, there, like after this episode and deeper into the season, there start to be problems with pacing and like the passage of time and like geography, like getting from one place to another. It starts like you can see the seams that they're stitching together to make the show work happen. That feels like much less of a problem in this episode. Like, it's a much better done episode of television, in addition to being a much more coherent story. But you can also see the ways in which it's going to plant seeds that are difficult to bring to fruition over the rest of it.
Yeah. So the meat of the episode really is that Antony turns up at Octavia and Attia's house and is kind of like, we gotta get out of here.
Yeah, we gotta bounce.
We gotta bounce, sister. This isn't looking good. There's like a very funny conversation where he's like, they just killed Caesar. He's dead. And she's like, well, how do you know he's dead? And he's like, I was there. And she's like, well, if you were there, why didn't you stop him? And he's like, look, I was there, but like, I wasn't there.
I wasn't like stopping it there.
When she's talking shit about how she would have fought them off with her bare hands, and he's like, you know nothing of violence. it's such an insane line, because you could tell in her heart of hearts, she does absolutely believe that she would have beaten them off with her bare hands.
Yeah.
No question at all in her mind.
Absolutely.
And the reality of her actually having to whoop someone's ass has never crossed her mind. Like, we have people for that.
Yeah,
like,
I think there are people who do this job. That's definitely true. But that is, I think that does snag on something that I wanted to bring up as well, which is, it is very interesting to say to a woman in the ancient world that she knows nothing of violence, because no, she knows
True.
Nothing of militarized violence, but the life of even a kind of rich and well-connected woman in the ancient world is a very, very violent one way or the other. And your integrity of body and being is absolutely reliant on the mercy of the men around you, which Attia certainly knows about violence. She just doesn't know about.
She certainly slapped Octavian.
She definitely slapped Octavian.
I reckon she could take Tobias Menzies, to be honest.
There's no question about that. That's 100% true. But we see her inflicting violence at multiple other points in this show, but it's always directed at people down the social scale, right? Like, she's whooping slaves. She is whooping her children, right? Like, there are multiple instances where we see her beating slaves or ordering violence to be done to other people, but there's always a social divide or a physical divide if that violence is inflicted on people of her class, right? Like, she has people go fuck up Servilia. She doesn't do it herself.
Yeah, and I think that it's interesting as well, because we talked a little bit last series about how I didn't strictly care for the little suggestion that they make that Brutus is pushed into his role in the conspiracy by his mother, and there's this quite unpleasantly misogynist kind of scorned woman storyline, which regrettably carries over into this episode when we see Sevilia. She is playing this sort of manipulative power behind the throne figure. And I've brought this up before, but I think it's so interesting that they chose not to include Fulvia as a character, and they sort of fold Fulvia into the person of Attia instead, because for the non-specialists in the audience, Fulvia was Mark Antony's wife, and she was a very interesting figure, and she was feared, and she was hated, and there was an obsession amongst her enemies that she was going to raise an army. This was one of the big fears about women. It wasn't that they were weak and stupid. It was that they had to be utterly stripped and kept away from any kind of meaningful material power, because if they had it, they would go mad with it, which is quite interesting. And it's an interesting comparison compared to how a 5th century Athenian would think of women, which was much more, well, they're weak and they're feeble-minded. And so this idea of particularly kind of aristocratic Roman matrons being the most kind of monstrous and cruel and callous general that would ever have lived and would ever have commanded men if only they were given the opportunity to do it. So I think that given that there is
like
a sort
of 12-step program for any kind of power, like you can't give them even a drop or they'll be
right back on the power wagon.
It's so fascinating, because I've just been reading a lot of Herodotus, because I've been writing episodes for Tides of History on the Greco-Persian Wars, and there's this character who pops up around the naval battle of Salamis in 480 BC, or Queen Artemisia of Halicarnassus. And she's like, she is Herodotus's quintessential powerful woman, but she is only powerful in the context of the inverted world of the barbarians. Right? Like, so it's only because the barbarians are so effeminate and strange and weird that they are allowing this woman to have power. And it's only in this world turned upside down of effeminacy and despotism that this woman can be a powerful and important actor. Yeah. Like, it's very strange. Like, that could never happen in Herodotus's world, in the world of the Greeks that he's portraying, right? So there isn't even, in that case, he's not even betraying anxieties about women's power, because it's so unimaginable to him. It can only happen in a world that he doesn't fully grasp or understand.
And because there's a full subversion, because Artemisia is framed as masculine.
Exactly.
So she's their king. She's their woman king. So I think it's interesting, given that there is some narrative interest in the ways in which the female characters wield what power is available to them, and how that's done within sort of fairly limited parameters. And that is done more successfully in some areas than others. I think the way that Attia is written is fantastic. I think the way that Sevilia is written is less than ideal. And it just seems surprising not to have a character like Fulvia, who offers so much kind of richness of interpretation. But I suppose that in the eyes of the showrunners, she's just too similar to Attia as a figure, and that maybe that would sort of cause a sort of confusion. But I just think it's a shame.
Well, I think it's also a sign of this show having been made when it was. Yeah. Right. Like, that's, it's also one of those weird ways in which you can see, oh, this is a product of a different era of television production, where if you told people, the kind of people who are trying to make a prestige TV show in the early 2020s, that you have all of these different powerful and important women in the show, every single one of them would be a main character, right? Because the dynamic and the context of the show would be much different. Whereas here, like, you can tell this is a product of that the Rome show was made by people who grew up watching Sword and Sandals movies. Yeah. Right. Like, so it's a subversion of that genre in a whole bunch of really interesting ways, but it is still also a product of those, as opposed to being a product of two decades of prestige TV and, you know, the social movements of the early 21st century.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think it would be absolutely, absolutely cracking to have a kind of sort of white queen style treatment of the women of the late Republic.
Oh, I would watch the shit out of
that
show.
Yeah, me
too. Because in a whole bunch of ways, they're so much more interesting than the men are. Like, that Antony is made, I think Antony is made much more interesting in this series than he was in real life.
Yeah.
I think Cicero is made cleverer than he was in real life and not as annoying.
Octavian, which is saying something, given how annoying something. He is yeah,
which
in
is,
the TV
which
series.
Is saying something. Like, like Pompey Magnus, not that interesting a guy. Caesar, interesting but enigmatic in a lot of ways. And but like the women who populate this world, especially like Clodia. Like Clodia is, I think, the most interesting figure in the late Republic because of the way that she stands at the center of all of these different social networks, all of these different groups of people who are fighting for power while being a person who wields power herself. And oh yeah, also she's just happens to be connected to all the important literary figures.
I was going to say, is this the one who's supposedly Catullus's muse?
Yeah. So it's like, but like, she's a more interesting character than Pompey is, like, in pretty much every way.
Yeah.
That's my take.
Because there's definitely been sort of more laser focused treatments of imperial women. You know, there's a certain amount of interest in Messalina and the various Agrippinas knocking around the place, even in Livia, but the women of this period not so much. It's just not been done.
Even in the Spartacus series, her name escapes me, the woman who's played by Lucy Lawless in that, I can't remember the character's name. She's like the most interesting character in the entire series, hands down. She plays the gladiator school owner's wife.
I was about to make myself sound so stupid and say, "What do you mean, Xena Warrior Princess?" But no, that's a different show.
She was Byzantine Empire. Yeah, so we basically get into this situation where Mark Antony wants to fuck off immediately, but Atia and Octavian point out that they can't really leave without Calpurnia because it would look bad. So they go around to Calpurnia's house.
Atia doesn't say that. Atia is all set to leave without Calpurnia, but the rest of them do appreciate. Right.
She's
that
like,
they have
Calpurnia
to...
has shit vibes. We can't. Then they get around there.
She's
and then
just
they're
a
even...
drag. Calpurnia's a drag.
Yeah, they turn up at Calpurnia's house, and then Calpurnia's like, "Oh, you're the only people who have come to visit," and they're like, "Yeah," because everyone's like, "Fuck that." The Calpurnia hasn't yet thought of this, that like people are like, "Oh, I don't want to go around there. What if there's more killing?"
Yeah.
Calpurnia's like, "It's so weird that no one's turned up." is that a bloody ruse?
But this is part of the kind of the lack of precedence. And the Romans of this period hated a lack of precedence. It was like the worst thing that they could imagine. Like, even if the context was completely unprecedented, at least there was something to reach for, some kind of cloak of legitimacy. At least there was existing vocabulary to describe it, even if the vocabulary was completely inappropriate, like in that situation.
When anything crazy happens to you in the late Roman Republic, you must ask yourself, did this ever happen to Sulla? And if it didn't, you're
and
fucked.
And if it didn't, then it fucked. Yeah, then you're in serious trouble. So everyone is waiting for some kind of cue at this point. They want to be told what to do. They want somebody to show up in a purple dress with a big book and say, "Actually, we know exactly what to do." We have, you know, we have half of the Sibylline books here, and it tells us exactly what to do. And in fact, they do sort of know what to do, which is that Caesar is to be declared a tyrant, and his murder is to be declared a tyrannicide, which makes it, which confers legitimate, sort of legal legitimacy on it. But as Octavian points out, who has at some point or another been at the law books, which I think that's one of the things that is like a little bit unfortunate that this happens before the recasting, because he is just this little snot-nosed kid. And at what point has he developed this kind of brilliant legal mind? But he points out that if it stands that that it's a tyrannicide, then Brutus and all of his co-conspirators are in an extremely tricky position, because they have all been given their various senior political roles by Caesar. So if it turns out that he was a tyrannicide and therefore all of his decisions were illegitimate, then that means that they have to be subjected to an election. And none of them want to risk this, because Caesar is beloved by the people. And there are two people in this episode who are under the impression that the people are functionally an illegitimate social and political force. And that is Cicero, because he's Cicero and he is being Cicero about it. And there is Brutus as well, who is extremely naive in this episode. So one of the things that Brutus keeps saying is, no, we're not murderers. We wanted to end the tyranny of Caesar, but we mustn't go near Antony, which is stupid of him. This is a really, really fool move not to have also insisted on the death of Antony. And for that matter, not
he just
to
likes being called Brutus, me old cock, you know.
But also not to have insisted on the death of Octavian. If we're going to be if we're going to square our shoulders here, he absolutely should have insisted on the death of Octavian.
The conspirators have really gotten themselves into a Nadim Zahawi ass situation. They've accepted being made Chancellor of the Exchequer by Boris Johnson, then immediately called for his resignation, and then when he's resigned, they've gone, "I'm not going to resign though."
Well, we've got some. We do have some fun, much later Roman parallels, which again is a kind of interesting representation of how historiography works and how it often kind of ties itself up in knots. So, most of our accounts of the Emperor Domitian, who was Vespasian's younger boy.
Yeah.
Who is remembered as being this monstrous, evil despot, the worst emperor of all time, or certainly one of the worst emperors of all time.
Terrible emperor, one of the worst of all time.
Terrible, terrible.
Pathetic. Domitian. Very, very sad. Terrible Christmas party. Yeah.
No, I'm just waiting for you to finish.
Saturnalia at Domitian's house. Terrible food. Terrible. No garum. None anywhere. People saying, "Where's the garum? Dummy. Where's the garum?" He says, "It's coming." It wasn't coming.
Yeah. Now are you done?
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So Domitian is remembered in this sort of monstrous, despotic way, and there's nothing really to support that he was so much worse than any other emperor. Not really. And in fact, certainly in terms of his foreign and military policy, he was probably much less murderous than Trajan and Marcus Aurelius, for definite.
God, I was joking, but he kind of is Trump.
I mean,
like, aesthetically really bad, but in practice not really that much worse than anything else that's happened.
Yeah, I mean, kind of, yeah. So the reason that we have these villainous portrayals of Domitian is that most of our sources are from Trajan's period. So Domitian was murdered in the palace coup, and he was replaced by the senators who organized the coup. He was replaced by this emperor called Nerva, who was like 90 years old or something. He was just like old as shit. Like they were pretty much like, aren't we like the ancient Romans? Like, why are you 90? Like, how is this even possible? I thought that this didn't really happen because
just a literal placeholder.
Yeah. With the ancients. Like,
not only was Domitian Trump, but he was replaced by Joe Biden. Yeah. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
If you sneeze,
you die. And so they made him emperor on the understanding that he would adopt this young, big deal military guy called Trajan, and make him his heir and thus closing the lid on the Flavian dynasty and starting a new dynasty of good emperors, good with heavy, very heavy inverts around it. So our big sources, you've got your Pliny the Younger, you got your Tacitus, all writing under Trajan. But the reason that they are senators of their rank and influence is because they were made senators of their rank and influence by Domitian. All of them, all the big historical sources under Trajan were advanced under Domitian. So they had to put the boot in. And as a result of that, we have this curious picture of Domitian, which really doesn't add up with more contemporary sources. And we have a sort of similar thing with the aftermath of the death of Caesar, which is, what do you do when your patron dies? What happens? Whose side do you pick? What's your move? And so this whole episode is people trying to decide what their move is, considering what's happened. And this is how Octavian comes up with this idea of a kind of general amnesty, because Brutus doesn't want to risk an election. It gets put to him, you'll have to put yourself up for election. Do you think that you will succeed given the circumstances? Cicero says, yeah, but you know, it's fine because we've got the support of the Senate. We've got the support of the Knights. Everyone else is going, oh, okay. So Cicero is the only one who seems to be under the impression that the people have absolutely no power as a kind of civic bloc. So we can just safely ignore him. Brutus is sort of saying, yes, but surely the people will love us because we are the tyrannicides. And everyone else is, no, he gave them money. They liked him. You're lucky that you haven't all been like tackled and murdered in the street by an angry mob. And Antony points out later that he has an angry mob at his disposal who he could unleash on them at any time. But if they let Brutus, Cassius, etc., continue with their plan for the aftermath, then that means that they all have to go into exile and hiding. So they suggest this kind of everyone's a winner situation.
The Brutus being incensed about being named the grain official,
yeah,
was just perfect, because like the come down for him from being tyrannicide hero to grain controller, a role that is actually much better suited to his particular talents or lack thereof, is that it's hilarious. The scene is played so well. It's so well written. It's just perfect. I love that.
Grain's very important, Bruce.
I mean, you look at the Gracchi brothers, grain is what did for them.
Mm. Mm-hmm. It's true. Yeah. Caused a lot of problems under Caligula. Lord only knows.
Yeah, well, that's because of his tum. He was celiac.
That's right, yeah. There's not a lot of people know that. The first gluten intolerant emperor.
The first gluten intolerant emperor, indeed.
Yeah, the organization. So basically, they decide on this kind of like entente where the will of Caesar will stand and also they'll all keep their jobs and everyone's kind of friends again. And then Servilia is like, well, what if we don't agree to be friends with you, Mark Antony? What will you do? And he's like, I'll probably just kill you all. And then they're like, oh, right, yeah,
I forgot about this, like, ultra-violent man with no real sense of consequence. Yeah, no, 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 yeah, all right, you know what, yeah. Fair play.
And then we get the great day of the funeral, it's very almost like Richard Curtis movie-esque, where, you know, Attie is up, she's got a black dress on, Mark Antony is refusing to get out of bed, and he's like, I've never fucked anyone in a funeral dress before, and she's like, yeah, that's not, it's not going to happen today either. And then he's like, well, I won't get up until I've fucked something. And then she's like, get the German slut from the kitchen.
Let's just give him a slave. But I think that's another thing that the show does quite well, which is whenever you get lulled into a feeling of like, well, this is relatable. This is something that I understand. These are the same anxieties and hopes, fears, and dreams that sort of animate the context that I'm used to. And then it rug pulls and reminds you of the fact that they kept human beings as property, and that if your boyfriend was horny and you didn't fancy it, you could just give him a slave to rape.
Yeah, there's the absolute casual cruelty that runs through this show is its most brilliant thing, where, because it's not like in Game of Thrones, the contrast between these two, because I think they're a lot alike in a lot of different ways, but where they differ the most is that Game of Thrones uses violence for shock value. Mm. And in Rome, it's just totally embedded in the structure of the world. It's like it is the absolute baseline thing, the baseline expectation that people above will use violence on people below and won't even think about it as a thing.
Because
like,
they're not people, they are property. Yeah, it's the bedrock. It's the bedrock of it. And this is why I think that. I absolutely agree with you, Pat. The absolute unthinking casual cruelty that runs through it is such an important, such a well done thing. And I think that they lose their moral nerve when it comes to the characters who they have invented for the purpose of this show. When it comes to our very own Forrest Gumps, to Varinus and Pullo, they can't quite bring themselves to make them as bad as the real historical
gun party
characters. Yeah, so there is in this episode, there is, because we talked about this last season where I said that I was concerned that they were going to be giving Pullo a redemption arc after he basically unprovoked murders the slave, and that fear was proved to be well founded, because he has since asked the sexy Greek slave to marry him. He's freed her, and he says, "You're a free woman, and you are entitled to refuse me." But again, what does this freedom actually mean? How does it manifest itself? Is she actually entitled to refuse him?
It's the famous Always Sunny bit where Dennis is. Are you guys watch Always Sunny in Philadelphia? Okay, yeah. The scene where Dennis is talking about getting the women on the boat and they're
because
not going to refuse
the
because of the implication.
No. That's exactly what it is. And he mentions murdering this other slave, and it's sort of the comic relief of the episode. It's sort of passed off as a joke, and either they are making an incredibly complex point about how violence as an animating force of this period of time and of this society is so deep rooted that even people who are supposed to be quite decent are fundamentally deeply, deeply monstrous and violent people, or it's supposed to be the comic relief, and it's sort of supposed to be a kind of what am I like? Anyway, I don't care. I don't care for that.
We had a great comic moment when we were watching it, because Annabelle pointed at Irene and went, "Who's that again?" And I was like, "Oh, she's the slave that he rescues when he's in Gaul, but then he rapes her and murders her boyfriend." And at that precise moment, Pullo went, "I know you and I got off on the wrong foot."
Yeah, I mean, that's it. But that's exactly this is exactly the point I'm making. I regret to inform you, I thought they could have done something far more interesting with Varinus in this episode, along the what happens when your patron dies. What happens if your entire fortune is tied up with one of these great men? What happens if the great man falls? What happens to you then? But instead, we've got the stuff with, so his wife has killed herself, and then his children get kidnapped and then also raped and murdered, and I can't get interested in Varinus's Dark Night of the Soul. I don't care.
It's sort of weird because you don't realize that Erastes Fulmer, who is also just like a hilarious villain, because every time he actually comes into conflict with Varinus and Pullo, he just gets the shit kicked out of him, but he keeps coming back for more. And he takes away, is it his Varinus's sister-in-law and the kids?
Yeah.
And then you just kind of assume that they're going to come back later. Pullo and Varinus go and they kill all of Foreman's men and they interrogate him. And he's like, oh, yeah, I raped and killed them.
Yeah, but it felt like it was much more so than in the last series, where I thought the kind of the fortunes and the narratives of Varinus and Pullo being the, you know, sort of demonstrating what it's like to be a relatively ordinary person, and how the tremendous upheaval and sort of an enormous changes of the time are affecting ordinary people, even ordinary people who are connected to people that we know about. And I thought that was sort of woven in pretty well to the rest of the narrative. But this just felt like, to be honest with you, whenever Varinus was saying, oh, I shouldn't have cursed them, oh, I shouldn't have yelled at my wife until she killed herself, you just sort of think, can we get back to the actual story, please? Can we? I'm not interested in this.
It would have been it would have been harder to do, but I think it would have made for a much better thing if they actually were dead, right? Like, that if... Okay, you want to talk about Varinus is going to suffer the consequences of his actions, right? Yeah. Like, if the whole reason that these characters exist in a narrative sense in this show is to show us how the actions of the great and the good and the rises and falls of these things affect the lives of the people who live in this city, then the upheaval surrounding the death of Caesar and the fall of Varinus as Caesar's guy means that his family suffers about the worst fate that you can imagine. After all, through actions of his own doing, right? Like, if that's the argument that you're trying to make, if that's thematically what you're trying to do, then fucking go for it.
Yeah.
Right. Like, then, like, have the courage of your convictions to have the children be murdered. If that's the
This is what I mean about there being a sort of certain amount of cowardice. It's like in Mad Men, where they have Don not being a racist, which doesn't really chime with what someone like him would have been like in the early 1960s, but they do that in order to make him a sort of halfway sympathetic main character.
It's kind of like fantasy football, right? You only get so many points, and they used up all of Don Draper's points on being a misogynist, so
yes,
they couldn't,
that's, yeah,
they
so
had
they
no
couldn't
points
have it
left for racism.
Yeah, yeah, so I think it's a sort of similar sort of thing where they kind of lost the stomach for it, and it's sort of all right to kind of portray historical atrocities because that's real and that happened, but showing the horrible murders of this sort of fictionalized man's children is a bit sort of, yeah, but we've made that happen, so we can't show it because that's too much and too far. Or they're doing a kind of a soap opera thing where it's not actually true, but I can't remember whether or not it's actually true.
Yeah. I thought it was suspicious because normally
but considering there's a whole thing about him throwing the bodies in the river, which is significant because this is being kind of set up.
It's very bad for the water table.
It's very bad for the water table. Yeah. But this is being set up deliberately, I think, in tension with the discussions about what kind of funeral Caesar is going to have. Is he going to have the hero state funeral? Is he going to be treated as a traitor to the Republic?
Throwing him in the river option, not given much consideration.
No one has really brought up that. Maybe Sevilla wouldn't mind the throwing in the river option. But the idea of, you know, the idea of like what is kind of respectful treatment of the dead is something that's kind of it's sort of running through thematically.
Well, in his will, Caesar's actually said he'd quite like to be put in one of those pods and have a sort of a tree grown out of him.
Yeah, He wanted a Viking funeral, which is weird to me because how does he know what a Viking is?
But he said
that he wanted to be put in a longboat, set alight, and pushed out onto the water. Now, where would he get an idea like that? What's he been reading?
Un-Roman is what that is. Should be a trireme.
That's very un-Roman.
Yeah. Or a quinkerine.
That's right. The problem with doing that on a trireme is a lot of innocent people have to die. Three whole decks of just guys rowing it out. I'll tell you what, it's not on here. We get this excellent bit though, where we have Caesar's funeral, and then Antony, you know, he rouses the rabble with Caesar's bloody toga and so on. And then when they go back to Servilia's house for a debrief, Brutus and Servilia, everyone else is like, "We fucking trusted you, Mark Antony, not to do any rabble rousing. And look at you, what have you done? You've gone and roused rabble.
I've done some rabble rousing. I've done some. What have you? What's that behind your back, Antony? It's angry mob."
Yeah,
give me the angry mob, Antony. No, don't wanna.
No,
it's mine.
The mob now.
It's mine. It's my mob. It's my rabble, and I'm not giving it.
And then Servilia is trying to put him down. She's like, "Yeah, well, any pantomime actor could have done what you just did." And he's like, "Well, it's a good job it wasn't, because otherwise you'd be sucking pantomime cock," which I just thought was such a beautiful image.
It's quite something, isn't it?
Pantomime cock is like a pantomime horse. It's like one guy is the balls, yeah, and another guy is the shaft. In a sort of two-person...
Which, ironically, is like a Roman comedy, so...
It's behind you, yeah.
Something that I'm aware that we're running out of time...
Oh, no, I wouldn't. Yell Servilia in response.
I'm aware that we're running out of time. But the last thing that I wanted to note, which I thought was interesting in this episode, which is, if your average person gets asked about what they know about Mark Antony. I say if you're an average person, like, I don't know where I've got that from.
It doesn't come up a lot for the average person.
It doesn't come up a lot. Maybe I should stop. Maybe this is the thing. I haven't done my market research on this. Maybe I should stand on the street corner with a clipboard.
Yeah, yeah. Asking people about Mark Antony.
What do you think of when you hear Mark Antony?
Well, I'm stood outside Betfred asking people's opinions on Mark Antony.
I'm telling them I'm a researcher for Pointless.
Yeah,
so that they agree to talk to me.
He's 4-2 to be Manchester United's next left back.
It's interesting you should say that, because so what I like about this is that if you ask someone on the street outside Betfred, as is our plan, this is what we're going to do after this, I assume.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I'm just going to go out and do some surveying.
Yeah, between the William Hill and the Wetherspoons, you'll see us there with a clipboard. Yeah,
people know about Antony and Cleopatra, and they know about the speech at the funeral.
Yeah,
this is what people associate. This is the popular imaginary of Mark Antony. It is friends, Romans, countrymen. It is that fucking speech. It is so interesting, I think, in terms of a narrative decision. I think this is really cleverly done, that you don't see the speech, that the speech is recounted by a Roman baz in a tavern, who gives us the briefest of windows into what a truly ordinary person is conceptualizing and taking from the events of this time. Varinus and Pullo don't really count. They're senior soldiers. They're close to Caesar. They're his men. They're his boys. But this is just some bloke. And it is, I think, one of the only times that this is done that you actually get a sense of what this is meaning for an ordinary person. What someone thinks about it. And I think it is such an interesting delivery system. I thought it was so inventive not to show Antony giving the famous speech where he holds up the bloodstained toga, but to hear it recounted through this ordinary Roman man. I thought that was fantastic.
I think that's a great point. Absolutely great point.
Yeah. And then Erastes Foreman going, "No, I don't like it.
No, I don't like it. It's rubbish. Dogs. Rubbish. I could have done that. Easy.
I've not even been a pantomime horse. There you go.
Is that the trajectory? Do you start as a horse and then you get upgraded?
It's a pantomime penis.
Yeah.
Well, it's yeah. complicated.
No, you have to play the balls first before you can be upgraded to the shaft.
Yeah. Because there's also on the pantomime horse, there is the pantomime dick, which is two smaller men.
Yeah.
Usually played by prepubescent boys.
Yeah.
Yeah, the pantomime horse.
So, from a kind of reincarnation perspective, the pantomime cock is the absolute pinnacle of pantomime evolution.
Pantomime horse killed in freak chariot accident. Four feared dead.
Four.
Well, yeah, because it's the two big. Guys playing the pantomime horse and then the two guys playing the dick. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
All right.
Anyway, well, this has been
on that note.
Episode 1 of season 2 of Rome. It's great to be back.
So great to be back.
Oh, I missed you guys.
I missed you too.
Oh, what a pleasure it's been. And thank you all very much for purchasing, listening, supporting the show. We'll be back very, very soon with episode 2. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.